Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
I'd like to welcome Chris Adelsback. Hi, Chris. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, it's taken me about a year, I think, to manage to pin you down. As Keith said, I had the pleasure of meeting you first properly. You'd have some good discussions at Henley Business Angels. So please kick us off first by giving us an introduction to yourself on that first, please, and your entrepreneurial and investment background.
Sure. Thank you. You'll tell by the accent, probably I wasn't born in the UK, but I've just passed my 24th year living here. Came over to the UK initially working for GE Capital and their consumer lending business. Did that for a number of years. And in 2005 and six, when I was given a P&L to run, I actually actively tried to reduce the balance sheet, reduce the lending. I sort of semi-famously said to my boss at the time that I think that we'd be better off actually just returning the capital back to GE parent, because I don't think that lending to people in the UK is a very good idea based on what I see in the data. And they backed me, and I wound up reducing the loans and getting us out of deals. And it came up to sort of like end of 2006, and I decided that this was just this felt like a lot of hard work. I was in a lending business actively trying to not lend. So I took that as a confidence to leave GE. I took a couple friends of mine with me, and we started a business called Marlin. And what Marlin went on to become was arguably the most profitable buyer, and I'd also say compliant buyer, of consumer non-performing loans from UK banks during the global financial crisis. So, when the sky was falling and the banks were doing poorly, we were sort of making hay and buying loans from the banks. We built that business out over the next sort of 6-7 years. We didn't take any VC money. I don't think we probably would have gotten any VC money if we even tried. And we didn't even take any angel money. We bootstrapped the business. And we took one round of capital from private equity after a few years. And then we continued to grow the business up to a point where we sold it. We were grateful, and we sold the business to probably the largest competitor in our space for just a shade under $500 million. And I took that as my opportunity to kind of step back and aside and out, and decided I was going to do something different. Now that I'd done my entrepreneurial stint, and I wasn't sure what to do. Actually, I'd been so focused as an entrepreneur. Sorry, I keep on seeing those little things in the chat, and it keeps throwing me off. Yeah, right. I was so focused as an entrepreneur that as a dad, because along the way my wife and I had three children, that there wasn't really much time to do a hell of a lot more. So I wasn't quite sure what to do. But I knew I liked startups, and I knew I didn't want to be an entrepreneur, having just spent 7 years being an entrepreneur. And an opportunity came to be a mentor. And I started mentoring startups. And I had a fortuitous meeting with a guy named Greg Rogers. He had just come to the UK, and he was given the task of starting a fintech accelerator for Techstars in partnership with Barclays Bank. And Greg was a very accomplished entrepreneur, had absolutely no background in financial services, but was brilliant nonetheless. And he sort of kicked that off, and that first program was really quite successful. And then he was asked to do something else, and he asked whether I would run that program. So for the next 4 years, I ran the Techstars fintech program, investing in 50 companies. And with a great deal of success. And in fact, on a few metrics, that program was called the number one fintech accelerator in continental Europe.
Yeah. So, I've had some good dealings in that with Techstars, and but there's a podcast as well with one I did with the Oslo Techstars, which is sort of energy sort of focused. And I'm an admirer of the structure and approach that Techstars sort of takes.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. So I although I have left Techstars, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, joining the mafia. You can never, you know, you try to get out, they keep pulling you back in. So I actually was on the investment committee of the Energy Accelerator, which is a partnership with Equinor, sort of 2 weeks ago. So I helped choose the 10 companies that would go through there. And I also took part in the investment committee for the 10 companies that are going through the Abu Dhabi program that's in partnership with Hub 71, which is backed by Mubadala, which is the sovereign wealth fund, one of the sovereign wealth funds there. So it, like I said, I really, really enjoyed it. I just love working with founders. And even though I've now stepped back from my full-time role at Techstars, now I just love just giving my time on a, you know, on a kind of a piecemeal basis to some of the programs. But during that time, I was given the green light to invest as an angel. And what I found is in my first year, I sort of invested in kind of anything, and that was a bad strategy. And although I think some of the founders I backed in that first year were fantastic, you know, financially it hasn't really worked out that well in that first year. But after that first year, I really started focusing on a vertical that I had a reasonable amount of knowledge in, which is, you know, financial services or fintech. And of course, fintech is super, super broad, right? So there's payments, there's, you know, wealth tech, there's regulation technology, insurance, things like that. So although I say that I have a decent understanding of, it's a really, really broad space. And I quickly realized that if I wanted to operate, you know, in the what I say is broad fintech, I'd have to surround myself with great people and great mentors. And that's what I learned, I think, working at Techstars is, you know, as a startup, you can be fantastic. You could be incredibly intelligent. You could build a good team. But, you know, the secret behind, I'd say, early stage startups is just assembling a group of great mentors that can actually kind of accelerate you, right? That's the whole idea about accelerators. And so I probably spent as much time in the first few years working at Techstars meeting mentors as I did meeting companies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it took a little while, but we put together a group of 100 amazing mentors. I would always get feedback from the companies on the mentors. And every year I would cut my bottom 10% of my mentors based on the feedback of the companies, right? And you do that for 5 years, and at the end of the 5 years, the people you have are pretty substantial. I mean, they're really, really excellent. And this group of mentors, maybe it's a London thing, I'm not sure, but I'd say by the end of the 5 year I was working there, about 50% of them had been converted into angel investors.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm really proud of because, again, at this sort of stage of investing, you know, a lot of VCs will say, you know, you're too early, or we'd like to track you, or, you know, send us updates, and just not invest. And it's, and often you're relying upon on angels sort of getting you to that next stage. So the fact that we could come up with a really strong curated list of founders and a curated list of mentors, those mentors could actually see the success that was coming out of the program, and it gave them the confidence to invest, is sort of the one thing I look back on and I'm quite proud of. I sort of led from the front. I wrote those checks myself. And I guess this is something we'll talk about on the call. But at last check-in, I've done 92 angel investments. Wow. with my own capital. And then in addition to that, another 50 that I did as a managing director at Techstars.
Right. Great. Great. So after your 1 year learning and getting them focused on your fintech sort of area, that's where you've sort of been into. So lemons often ripen earlier and go bad. So how many have you lost out of your 90, or those the 90 sort of surviving? What's the sort of hit rate that you're feeling in that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a few numbers. So I've been investing for just under 7 years as an angel. Obviously I started slow and now I'm kind of investing a lot more now. So the average duration of an investment that I have privately is probably just over 3 years. I've written off 6 companies to zero. I have 8 companies that I backed that are worth between $100 and $600 million. And then everything else is in between that, right?
Right.
You know, without being pedantic and going in there. So like, you know, what is it? My internal rate of return as an angel investor at a 36-month duration is about just over 30%. Which if you look at, there's some data that's out by Cambridge Associates that kind of tracks VC funds. And obviously, you know, VC funds tend to be 10-year funds, and you often don't really know how successful you're going to be till you get to the end of that fund and when the cash is returned. But they do have a lot of data, and they have been able to kind of go in and say for the funds that they have data on, you know, what is the average money multiple or, you know, TVPI and IRR for funds at various stages, 1, 2, 3, 4 and beyond. Mm-hmm. And based on the data that I have in my quasi family office, I'm sort of upper 5%.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So bringing it sort of up to date, coming into the 2020, you know, the new year sort of started. What was your structure on that there? You just touched on it about you're being outrun sort of ventures because you left sort of Techstars. So what's the, so what was your start of 2020 like?
Yeah. I mean, 2020, how weird, because, you know, January, everything kind of seemed okay. I did some travel in sort of the first quarter of the year. Some of which I look back on and think that was probably a bad idea, but, you know, we didn't really know this at the time. But I did a trip out to Tel Aviv to meet some Israeli fintech founders, met up with a couple of friends of mine who are also investors, and one of them returned back to the UK. Another one needed to get out to the Middle East, and I didn't need to get to the Middle East after that trip. So I was going to Abu Dhabi, she was going to Dubai. And of course, until recently, like last month, you couldn't get a direct flight from Tel Aviv to Abu Dhabi. This is just open. This corridor is just opened up. So we're like, okay, let's go to Jordan. Yeah, we'll go to Jordan. We'll spend a couple nights in Jordan. We'll go see Petra. And then you go to Dubai and I'll go to Abu Dhabi. So, and my other guy, Eamon Carey, joined us as well. And we did this. We're in the car. We're going to Petra. We're talking to the driver, really great guy. We get to Petra, we're walking through, and he's kind of giving us information about Petra and about the people that come to Petra. And he said to us, he says, about 40% of the people that tend to come to Petra are from China. I'm like, oh, wow. And then you start seeing the masks. And I'd never seen the masks. This is like February. And that was, it really, and I know it's quite a common thing, you know, in sort of us. You know,
in Asia, it's been common for years there.
Super common. But, you know, we weren't seeing that in London, and I had never really seen it in that sort of quantity. And, you know, I'm walking literally through, you know, the that chasm towards the Treasury, and I see hundreds of people with masks on. And it was a great trip. I came home. My brother actually runs quite a large hedge fund advisory group, and I sent him a WhatsApp, and I was like, Patrick, I was like, God, I think this. You know, whatever we were calling it back in February, you know, let's call it COVID-19, even though I think we were calling it something different back then. This looks pretty, pretty serious. And he sent me something that was obviously some sort of like fake news from China that said, no, look at these data, it's all under control. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's made up. I said, I think this is going to be problematic. And I went and dumped a bunch of my stocks and bought gold. And that was like the 12th, the 9th of February, something like that.
Right.
And then I did a few trips after that. And of course, you know, shit hit the fan and there was lockdown. And, you know, the first day or 2 days of lockdown, I when we realized that we were going to be locked down for a while, I set up a WhatsApp group. And I purposefully put people on this WhatsApp group that were A, portfolio companies of mine, B, I would say much more enterprise ready companies, right? And see companies that I thought could be, you know, with a crystal ball that could be part of the solution or could be helpful as we kind of move through this problem. And the companies in that group was a KYB company called Company with a K out of Austria, that as far as I know are the only KYB platform.
So KYB, you need to
know your business. So mm-hmm. instead of know
yeah,
your customer.
Yeah, I was thinking know your customer, but yeah, okay, yeah.
Not KYC, KYB. So like, you know, underwriting a business before you give them money. So the view there was this is going to be pretty important because there's clearly going to have to be loans keep businesses afloat. And when, you know, when there's helicopter money, you know, there's chances for fraud. And company is unique in that it's in full compliance of the fourth and fifth European Money Laundering Directive, you know, which I'm sure we all know on this call from that. But it is. And the second company was called ShieldPay, which does instant digital escrow. So again, making sure that, you know, payments, large sums of payments reach their destination without being intercepted or, you know, miskeyed and things like that. We had a company called Nimbla, which does insurance, single invoice insurance. So for instance, if you and I, Andrew, were small businesses and we dealt with one another, I might be concerned that you may not pay me, right? And therefore I might say, I'm not giving you 30 day terms anymore. You got to pay me in advance. Right. And if that contagion got into the system because of that fear and everyone stopped giving everyone else, you know, 30, 60 day terms,
yeah.
You add it all globally, you lose 17 trillion of lending from the economy, right? So there was obviously, there's an insurance element that I wanted to be in that group. And we also had a company called Crowds, which offers supply chain as a service. So effectively a platform to allow companies, generally larger companies, to effectively bank or provide supply chain finance to their own supply chain, or indeed even deeper if they chose to, right? And this is kind of like part of this embedded finance theme that you hear more and more about. And then the final company is Rails Bank, which effectively is a banking as a service platform. And then we had a few other companies that kind of bobbed in and out on the WhatsApp. Well, 2 days later, that WhatsApp became a Zoom call. And that Zoom call became an 8:30 a.m. 5 day a week Zoom call, which lasted for about 14 weeks.
Right.
And on that call, it was pretty remarkable. We called ourselves like the COVID FinTech group, right? And, you know, collectively everyone had a pretty, you know, first of all, they had really interesting businesses that were relevant. Second, they were competent CEOs. And third, everyone had their own kind of network. And this is the hardest thing during the pandemic is, I think everyone was racing around trying to find a way to help. And obviously we saw on the TV, you have, you know, the frontline workers, the NHS, kind of, you know, the heroes, right, out there putting their lives at risk. And then the rest of us, you know, at home, you know, to be fair, you know, feeling a little cowardly, right? And I didn't, that felt really wrong, right? And I felt like I wanted to do something, you know?
Well, my experience on that was because of my context, one of my ventures produces clothes out of near Shenzhen. And one of my shipments got delayed. We'd ordered stuff sort of pre-Chinese New Year, got delayed. And then I saw this stuff coming through in February as well. And I was onto them in sort of saying, where's the shipment sort of coming? But by the way, have you got some masks? And we shipped in masks and we were distributing them to care homes at the end of March and through April, you know, for trying to help and that here, because you had the contacts, because your network and that is, it can be so powerful. So
for 20 pounds a mask, right?
Well, no, we were shipping them. It was 40p a mask.
Pulling your leg.
Yeah, but yeah, no, it made me sick when I saw some of the postings and that on the money that was made in getting them to the government and sort of stuff like that. And we were offering them to the NHS as well, but they wouldn't return our calls either. But
oh my gosh.
Hey, we tried to do our bit, but this is fascinating. This WhatsApp group.
And, yeah, I mean,
and seeing how the things are going to change.
And you know, it wasn't just like a talking shop. It was about action, you know. And you know, everyone was having their own private conversations with industry and government. But actually, what we quickly found out was that in order to get loans out in mass, in compliance and without masses amount of fraud, that we felt that our group, or at least some people in the group, were part of that solution. So what we tried to do, to a certain degree and, you know, a certain level of success, although I'd say I'm generally frustrated with how the whole thing went, was we spoke to a number of people within government, which were nameless, a number of people within industry, and then we made a big racket out on social media. And our big concern here was we felt that if you didn't have a solid KYB, know your business, solution in place, you potentially could underwrite businesses that A, you know, didn't exist. They could go to people that don't even live in the UK. You know, there could be just lots of fraud. We felt there was going to be lots of fraud. And the same thing with you know, the payments. You know, payments could get misdirected, lost. So we felt like the KYB, the Shield Pay, the escrow piece. And then we had another company. Sorry, I left one out. It was called Swoop. And we felt that Swoop had a solution because we felt that if you received a loan, if, especially one of these kind of effective bailout loans, that part of the deal should be you should sign up to connectivity through open banking so that government could actually see what's happened with this money, right? Because if they're going to provide 100% financial backstop by you and I, the taxpayer, you know, how much was going to be in place? Because it's one thing having bad debt because businesses fail, you know, it's another thing having bad debt because people misappropriate money or people lie, right?
Yeah.
So we fast forward to a few weeks ago, I think it was the FT that said they think the B bills, the loans, will generate somewhere in the region of 28 billion pounds of fraud. And of course, nearly in the same breath, you know, the Treasury, the Chancellor is talking about how much tax is going to have to raise and how potentially they're going to stick it to the entrepreneur and by, you know, getting rid of certain entrepreneurial reliefs and things like that. And for me, sitting here at home during a, you know, during a pandemic, that's a bit sad for me because I actually think that that could have been prevented. So the question I have right now, which I'll add to this group, and I know it'll be on the web, but I'd love to know whether the government bounce back loan guarantee says anything about whether that guarantee only is paid if the loans are written in compliance with the law. And therefore, if we could re-underwrite those with company and do a KYB check as of sort of April, May, June, this summer, if they would have failed that, then I would say taxpayers not taking that back. And I think that would be a great way to not put entrepreneur, you know, to not raise taxes on certain elements of society, whether it be entrepreneurs or, you know, taking away bus passes from elderly people, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have all these hard choices now, and I think that, you know, when, and obviously the sky was falling and people were moving very, very quickly, and therefore mistakes will be done, but it just seems a shame because this is something I think could have been done pretty easily.
I was seeing your messages and LinkedIn and Twitter on that, and seeing the level of frustration rising as we were going through that in the summer. So since March, how many investments have you actually sort of made now, and what's your feeling on the market?
Right, so I've made 15 investments since the 23rd of March, and I've made a further 4 commitments that will probably go through before Christmas. And then I've done a few follow-ons as well into companies that I had already invested in. Super active. Out of that group, I think 4 people I've never met face-to-face, which is really weird, especially with angel investing, right?
Yeah.
With any investing, to be fair, but like, For me, like, it's all about the founder, it's all about the person, and I'd sooner jump on a plane and fly to a city to meet a founder than do an investment without meeting them and the team. But, you know, you have to adapt and you have to change. And I decided that I would just try to change this way. But you find ways to do due diligence on people. And I've been using a platform that I'm an investor in that my friend developed called Bridge, which is brdg.app. which I'm a huge user of. And what Bridge helps me do is facilitate double opt-in introductions to people within my network. So for instance, if I found a company that I thought was really interesting, and there's Ross Murray Jones there on the call, I can see you. And I thought Ross was a guy that was, you know, really knowledgeable in a space that I had some knowledge of. What I would suggest to the founder was, hey, I know this person named Ross. He's really good at X, Y, and Z. I think he could help you. Would you like the introduction? And generally, most founders will say yes, right? So very quickly, I can facilitate that. Double opt-in. So now this introduction goes to the founder, and the founder is given Ross's, it links to his LinkedIn and whatever. They need to sell themselves. They need to say, okay, well, let's remind me of like why I want to meet Ross, because Chris told me I should meet him. And they got to put in something that says, here's my background. This is what I do. This is why I think it's relevant to meet Ross. right? That comes to me. I can add a sentence or something, and then I hit a button. It goes to Ross, and then Ross decides whether he can take the introduction or not. And then 2 weeks later, after hopefully you've met, the platform actually asks each of you what you thought of one another. And when you add that all together, what it means is, I found a founder, you know, do they think the introduction is relevant? Do they act on it quickly? Can they sell themselves well? Does the person I introduced them to actually think that looks interesting? Do they actually meet up? And what do they think after they met up? So yeah. If I do that with not just Ross, but two or three other people, I get like 5-6 data points for each person. And that helps me learn a lot quicker, especially when I can meet people.
No, that sounds really powerful, because you know, I find myself in a similar position with corporates and founders and other investors and sort of stuff like that. And as you said, you do that bit of making sure that the other person wants to speak to somebody else, but then it goes off into the ether, and it becomes quite a task to actually follow that up. So that's really, really good. The last question I wanted to raise or theme I wanted to raise with you, Chris, before we open it to questions, which I start seeing coming through, is sort of impact investing, sort of ESG sort of type in investing. I'm a big believer in it. I've just recorded a podcast with Nigel Kershaw, who's the founder of The Big Exchange, which is the big issue platform now for putting investment funds to help people invest in social impact, environmental sort of type things, you know, which the very essence of the big issue. And I've, as you've talked today, and as I've seen in your stuff, it's a big part of your investment strategy around fairness and diversity and sort of stuff like that. Can you give us a bit of background on how and why you do that, and why you do it for good feeling benefits, but also financial returns? What's your view on this sort of impact investing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they should go hand in hand. You know, I ultimately am investing for a financial return, but if I don't think that the company is of use to society, it's not a good use of my time, right? So I have gone a little off-piste, and I've invested in companies that aren't strictly fintech, but I am being true to my true north, in that I'm backing what I think are incredible founders and incredible teams. So in terms of like impact, you know, things that I've done, you know, fairly recently, I both invested and joined the advisory board of a platform called OneBanks. And what OneBanks aims to do is to be a shared platform for banking, because what we all realize is, you know, the high street banks are leaving the high street, and they're most certainly leaving smaller communities and rural communities. And there's a government initiative called Access to Cash, which is just acknowledging that although, you know, there's going to be this movement, there is this movement, massive movement to a digital economy and digital cash, there are certain members of society that are being left behind, right? and of course, if you're an incumbent bank, if you have a retail bank franchise, it's very, very expensive and increasingly becoming kind of just not worth it, right? So, you know, what do you do? And OneBanks basically said, well, listen, what you need is in a certain part of the UK, you need shared platform, right? So if you go to a small community, you know, that 10 years ago had 4 banks on the high street and now has none, maybe what you should have is one. But it's not going to be a Lloyds or an HSBC or a Barclays, it's going to be a OneBanks. And it's not going to sit in its own bespoke building, which is quite expensive. It's going to sit into a place with high footfall that won't leave the community anytime soon. So OneBanks actually did a deal with the cooperative, the co-op, which, yeah, they're across the UK. Often you find them in sort of smaller communities. And they're opening up their first, I'll say, kiosk, if you will, man, you know, person in a cooperative, and in a place called Denny, which I had never heard of, but it's in Scotland. And that opens up in the next few weeks. And that's quite exciting. And right now, what they're in the process of doing is just really just galvanizing support across all the banks. Because it's a great idea for the banks, because you know, every time they leave a community, I can just imagine if you're banked by one of these banks, what their customers think of their bank. You know, you've just left us. Yeah. And a lot of these people just don't want to go to the post office, right? That doesn't feel like a bank. And also, you know, one of the things around One Banks is, in addition to still giving people access to cash, there's a person there to actually help migrate them onto open banking and actually get them into the digital economy with a bit of handholding. So that's one that I think actually could make a lot of money, right? But I think actually serves a really important need. And although it's probably less fintechy than some of the stuff I've done, I think it's a great conduit between sort of where we are now and where we're probably going to go. Right. So that's like that's one example. But I've done a couple things. I backed a company called GrandPal, which effectively is a platform to combat loneliness in old people, elderly people. I invested in this about 18 months ago, so this wasn't a pandemic thing, which looks like it kind of looks like a no-brainer now, because to be fair, we could probably all use a GrandPal, right? Platform. But in particular, you know, this is for, you know, elderly people, right? So my parents live in the US. I'm concerned. I haven't been able to go back to the US for a long time. And, you know, GrandPal is a platform to help coordinate, you know, other family members and, you know, carers and things like that. So I think that is a business that actually is playing to, you know, a growing demographic and a huge need. You know, I'm sure a lot of us on this call are international people. We probably have family and friends that live abroad. Yeah. And as they age, you can just imagine, like, we're all kind of concerned about that. So a platform that helps facilitate, you know, caring for loved ones is important. But I wanted to make money. If these things make money, there's a great chance for me to take it off the table and reinvest in the next generation of entrepreneurs. And, you know, I spoke to, this is something I've been doing for a while, but like when I sold my company in 2014, I pledged that I would reinvest 50% of the proceeds straight back into entrepreneurs. And I've done about 30%.
Right. So you got a bit more to go then.
A little bit more to go, but you know, quite a lot. But if they make money, I'll keep on doing it. And so far, so good.
Good. And question from Sarah, what's your view on the anticipated level of investment at the seed stage going into 2021 now? Do you think it's going to increase, stay the same, decrease? What's the atmosphere going into the new year?
I think for early stage, I mean, to some extent, it comes down to whether the government chooses to, you know, crater British entrepreneurship by removing EIS and SEIS, right? So, you know, if the Treasury wants to kill jobs and kill the economy and kill hope, remove that.
Yeah.
And I can tell you one thing, I know a lot of people that I brought into the world of, you know, angel investing, right? Those 50 people I mentioned, and not all of them, but I'd say majority of them, we got them over the line because of the tax efficiency, right?
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of it will come down to, you know, next year's budget. And if that stays in place, I think it will accelerate. Because I think two things could happen. One is if they harmonize or increase capital gains tax on other assets, right? It's going to make early stage investing or EIS investing that much more attractive, right?
Okay, good point.
But if they get rid of it and the government thinks that I'm going to invest with the same risk appetite in an untraded early stage company as the same as Microsoft, well then it's time to leave government and go work for a company and learn how the real world works, you know?
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's great. Great. Thanks for that. Trust that covered sort of Sarah's point. So let's open up the microphone for some others here, because so we're going to be broadcasting that, the section we've just done, but I'd be interested in opening up back to the point I was making earlier. I think, you know, Techstars, Y Combinator, Solid 500, as you sort of mentioned, I think are fantastic places for these. And in my book, I outline it from the corporate side about why corporate should be involved in those ecosystems. And I think the way that Techstars structured them was a fantastic way for them to learn about tech, learn about startups, and be backing the trends that are coming along. And I think, you know, I encourage a number of my investments to get involved in those in those areas and that as well. I do a plug as well, Sarah, and others who are on the call on that here today, to participate in Henley Business Angels. So a local group, connected in that with what Dennis said earlier. There's a bunch of us who are, you know, and Keith, we're angel investors, roll our sleeves up, help, mentor, coach these organizations, bring in the sort of insights from us being involved in other networks and sort of stuff like that as well to create the connections with these entrepreneurs and all that. So that's great. If anybody's interested in participating in next week's and sit in their armchair and watch the pitches from Henley Business Angels, then just drop me a note. So that's great. Chris, really pleased. Thank you very much for your participation in that today. The value from your insights has been fantastic. This has been a free webinar, but we do get donations from people, and we've been donating recently to the Big Issue and World Vision with the donations that people have made when they've come on to our sessions and that here. So thank the people who've made those donations. So finally,
we'll use the QR code over your shoulder. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you can certainly get in touch with me with that QR code. But there's the resources, the list of podcasts and things that I've done are on that QR code. But it's interesting, a final little story that for me, I did a startup in QR codes for recycling coffee cups and for doing a payments platform about 3 years ago. And to be honest, I folded it because people didn't understand what QR codes were here. Now I've still got all that content. I'm ready to resurrect it and that again. So the pandemic might see a phoenix rise from one of my ventures. So, Chris, thank you very much again. You've been so generous with your time and insights and been so engaging. Thank you very much. And thank all of you for participating.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Please subscribe to future podcasts and please give us a 5-star rating on your platform. Thank you.